Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Much has been made of the fact that the U.S. Senate now has 20 female members. New Hampshire's governor, two senators, and two representatives are all women. While women clearly are increasing their numbers on many political levels, moving to the highest rung on the political ladder has remained elusive. Hillary Clinton ran for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2008. She lost. She may run again in 2016. Fact is, the glass ceiling has always been strongly in place when it comes to national elective office for women in this country. We have some catching up to do in that regard, with many countries all over the world still, in the overwhelming number of cases, men dominate the offices of head of state or head of government. The question is why, and what will cause that to change? That's our subject today. With me in studio is Farida Jalalzai, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Missouri-St. Louis. She's the author of the new book, Shattered, Cracked, or Firmly Intact, Women and the Executive Glass Ceiling Worldwide. Farida, so nice to see you again. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Congratulations on the book. This represents a lot of work on your part. I can see that.
It's a lot of work, but it was really a type of subject that I've always been interested in, and so it was enjoyable, believe it or not.
I'm glad for that.
Yeah.
Farida, is there a political gender bias in this country?
Yes. I think that they're subtle. Most of the times, they're subtle. Other times, they're more overt. And I think the subtle aspects would include gender stereotypes that maybe pigeonhole women to take more feminine roles, have more of a feminine style. And likewise, we have a lot of perceptions of what a real man should be, what masculine attributes he should have. But when we look at political office, often, though not always, the same kinds of traits and attributes that we might associate with political positions are more often those that are masculine. Less often, although I think it does depend on the position, less often do we view political positions as having this value in feminine traits, feminine types of behaviors. That's the subtle, I think, aspect. And then the more overt ones that I see operating in this country definitely figure into media coverage. I think that you can see this at all levels of races. And it tends to go in line of appearance, critiques for women. Not to say that we don't concentrate or journalists don't ever bring up the looks of male politicians, but I think that it's just something that's much more likely to affect women. And I also think that questions about family status are brought up more when it comes to women candidates.
You refer to it as gendered media bias, I believe, in your mm-hmm. book. Is that actually
gendered media bias?
Right. Well, and one of the cases you cite in the book is Geraldine Ferraro, who mm-hmm. ran for vice president in 1988. I don't remember the numbers offhand, but you cite the number of times that references were made to her clothes and made to her hair as opposed to things she was talking about.
And to her husband, her mm-hmm. husband's financial dealings. And we often remember the question that she had to field about, as a woman, would you be brave enough to push the button or strong enough to push the button, from the Meet the Press moderator. And those are just the types of questions that women might be asked and the types of coverage that they may have to disproportionately endure.
And yet she did rise to that level of at least mm-hmm. being on the ballot. And unfortunately for her, she was running with a guy who announced at the convention they wanted to raise everybody's taxes, which didn't help her very much. And then there was Sarah Palin, who mm-hmm. also got to that particular level. And Sarah Palin is Sarah Palin. But doesn't this mitigate at all against the notion of a gender bias?
How so?
Because they got there.
Well, it's not just about, well, did they get there?
Well, they got on the ballot. They got on the ballot.
They got close. They got on the ballot.
Right.
But I think ultimately you want the prize, and the prize isn't being on the ballot. It's a step closer, but the prize is to be vice president, or really the prize is to be president.
Hmm. Okay. They're ancient history in a sense, so let's
maybe
move
not,
on.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
Maybe not.
I'd like
anyway.
To take a look at what is going on in other countries. My count, I think we have I could be wrong. There are 28 female chiefs of state or chiefs of government around the world, some 200 nations. At first glance, you might think some of the names we hear all the time, like Angela Merkel mm-hmm. and people like that, you'd think that there are a lot more women out there. But really, they're not so much more progressive than we are, I take it.
Well, I think that we are simultaneously, as a world, dealing with two dynamics. The first dynamic is that women are enjoying these positions as heads of state or presidents, prime ministers, more than they have so 10 years ago, even, you know, 5 years ago. We've seen women making enormous strides over the last few decades in getting that position. But that also leaves the reality intact where that's a small, just it's such a teeny fraction of positions that are available that would lead one to believe that I think my book continually asserts that we haven't really made as much progress as one would maybe hope 50 years after the first woman gained a prime ministership.
But we are there's a certain momentum now. It appears that way in any case.
It seems so. I was just looking at updated figures. The book mainly goes through 2010. And if you just look at the last three and a half years, we've had another 15 women joining that elite club. That's pretty good. That really represents a vast increase over other periods, recent periods of time even. And so that's a positive thing. But I would also give caution before making too many conclusions or deriving too many conclusions from that and thinking that, oh, women are gaining these positions all over the world and in all of these countries that, you know, they haven't before. And I'll explain that a little bit. The interesting thing whenever I update my numbers is so looking at the quantities, the individual women, but also where they're coming into power. And whereas there's generally, like, of course, this noticeable uptick in the quantities of women, the map as far as where they're landing, it's not changing as much. And the title really comes from this noticing of a fact that instead of just saying, well, women are shattering the glass ceiling, it just sort of seemed like, okay, well, this country, there's been three women or there have been four women, as in the case of Switzerland that have come into the presidency. But in other cases, there's been one and they're done. The United Kingdom, for example, they're done for now. And then in other places like the United States, the glass ceiling seems like it's firmly intact. So to me, what has always been interesting is that there doesn't seem to be as much movement when you're thinking about new places that women are coming into power.
And it seems that where it is happening, they are largely less developed countries.
When I bring in the level of development as a statistical control, it doesn't really work in predictable ways. Mm-hmm. So they come in contexts that are developed. They come in contexts that aren't developed. And likewise, they come into contexts where democracy is vibrant, and they come into contexts where democracy hasn't really been consolidated yet. So it's just sort of the firsts were the ones who came in developing countries and led the pack before the developed world. But now you're seeing, you know, lots of women coming into developed societies as leaders and lots of women coming in more developing societies as leaders. So I think it's sort of in that way, it's all over the place.
How is their path to power where it is working, where they have achieved? How is it different than here?
Well, there are a lot of things going on. And I think institutions come to my mind as one of the most noticeable factors that seem to determine where women succeed. We do know that women have an easier time becoming prime ministers in parliamentary systems. And one of the explanations for this possibly is that they don't have to rely on a general population vote to become that leader. They would go through parties. They would go through
political parties. Let's make sure everyone understands that.
So political parties. And sometimes women work their way up the ranks and gain appointment that way. Where they've gained positions through the popular vote as presidents, often they've been weak presidents. And so a good example would be how Ireland has had now two different female presidents, but has virtually zero power. We also have the dynamic in a lot of African countries where a woman has become prime minister, but at the selection of the president, who is the one that really holds the power. And so when I first started this research line, I was interested in just kind of getting a sense of who made it and what their stories entailed. And then it became much more about, well, what powers do they really have? Because you could really question women's progress as executives if they're not the executives that hold the preponderance of power in a system. That's not to say that you don't have cases now, like an Angela Merkel, who is what I call a dominant prime minister, who has a lot of visibility internationally, especially when we think about economic issues. That doesn't mean that you don't have a Dilma Rousseffi in Brazil, who came in as president. But what happens more often than not still is women are placed in these positions, say, for example, prime ministers, where they're always, just by the fact of the position or the nature of the position, vulnerable to being ousted at any time. I think the ultimate prize for women would be to gain a dominant presidency and to do so without family ties and to do so through the popular vote.
Family ties is one of the things that has been part of the path for so many of them over the years.
Right. Yeah. So when you really get into the stories of these women, almost always until really recently, the dominant presidents, the ones who held dominant power in a system, who were elected by the popular vote, were wives or daughters of former presidents or opposition leaders.
One of the things that struck me in reading your book was the fact that we think historically of people like Catherine the Great, Elizabeth I, and Queen Victoria, for instance, just for starters, and how strong they were and how successful they were. And yet that doesn't seem to count very much for the subsequent generations of political leadership.
Right. And I think that historically they have a lot of import and can really challenge people's imaginations of what a woman can do. But until that really catches up with the more modern reality, then, you know, even with that symbolic import, you know, I think people ultimately want women's significance in a host of political positions that span all of our different, I think, levels of government and want something, you know, role models for now.
Yeah. But before I take the break, I alluded to this in the introduction with regard to New Hampshire and what's been going on there and the Senate, House of Representatives, a fairly strong representation there. Why is this happening? I mean, there have been a number of important chief executive officers of corporations who are female. This is going on at the same time.
It's going on at the same time, but I think, what is it, something like 4% of CEOs are female? It's not
that some pretty high-profile ones, however.
There's some high-profile ones. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that there haven't been strides that women are making. But I would never look at the United States as the model of where women are gaining these positions, powerful positions. Because even if, like, I think now the current statistic is overall 19% in Congress and 20% in Senate, particularly the highest. Do you know how many other countries beat us when it comes to women's representation, descriptive representation?
I could go to the appendix of your book.
You could go.
That, but I don't know it off the top of my head.
Or you could go to Interparliamentary Union and find that, you know, we're not doing well. We're not doing well legislatively. I mean, even in recent history, women's, since the Year of the Woman, okay, that was pointed to as the breakthrough year, you know, 1992, women have really just kind of inched up and inched up. Rather than these dramatic increases, given that women have now gained higher levels of education in various domains than their male counterparts, and that they have made strides in certain professions, I think people would have expected maybe more.
Well, more female college graduates today than men, and maybe that will come into play sometime in the not-too-distant future. My guest is Farida Jalalzai, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. She is the author of the book Shattered, Cracked, or Firmly Intact, Women and the Executive Glass Ceiling Worldwide. I think the title of the book gives a pretty good indication of what we're talking about. We're talking about women in politics worldwide and the success that they've had, while they've not had the similar kind of success in this country. We'll come back and talk more about it, and of course, we'll bring in some well-known names that are being discussed as a possible contender in the next election cycle. Back in just a moment. We'd like to get you into the discussion as well. Don't forget our number, 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org, and we'll take a tweet at STL on air. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back to our conversation with Professor Farida Jalalzai, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. And we're talking about her book, Shattered, Cracked, or Firmly Intact, Women and the Executive Glass Ceiling Worldwide. Farida, what do women bring to the table when it comes to high political office?
It depends on the woman, of course, but I think that it offers the potential for powerful role models for women, young girls. Some of the leaders that have gained office, like maybe Gro Harlem Brundtland from Norway would be a good example, or Michelle Bachelet of Chile, they do bring different issues. They bring a different take on issues, issues that are stereotypically associated with helping women, trying to enact legislation to improve women's lives. I think you can look at some cases. Maybe Dilma Rousseff in Brazil is a good example of female presidents who make it a mission to try to appoint other women to high-profile offices in the administration. Of course, men can do this and have done this. I think France would be a good example, or in the past, Spain, where the male leader has appointed a lot of women. But there, I think, is a greater possibility that a woman who has this type of power of appointment could, if she wanted to, bring in more women, that it doesn't always happen that way. I think counterexamples would be a Margaret Thatcher or an Indira Gandhi, who didn't make it their mission to try to bring women's issues to the table, or to also bring in other women into positions of power. But I think that it in general, makes people think that the system may be more open, maybe more democratic, maybe more legitimate. It also potentially offers positive role models, so that it wouldn't be unusual for a young girl to just imagine one day becoming president. And when we think about the gap in women's and men's office holding in the United States, what the research continually finds is that there is a real gap between women and men when it comes to efficacy. In particular, women's feelings of self-confidence, also, that they don't feel confident. I think we were together with Richard Fox, remember, several years ago now, who talked about the women who have the most qualifications, who we usually consider to be part of the eligible pool, who continually underrate themselves. And so I think that high-profile women, visible women, who are conducting business internationally and representing their countries, have the potential of making young girls think of themselves as potentially powerful people. Maybe one day they become candidates.
All of the things that you just mentioned apply well outside the political realm as well. I mean, that's universal, way women think of themselves and the way that they are held back. Let's talk for a moment before we go to the phones about Hillary Clinton.
Okay.
I mean, this is the big story. Is she going to run? Is she not going to run? We talked before we went on the air, and you don't think necessarily that she's going to, or that she could win.
I think that right now what we're seeing is she's being recruited to run. And I don't know that anybody really has a sense of whether or not this is something that she's going to do. But I think that there's a desire among some Democratic elites for her to run. And so that's the question. Will she run? And then will she take the primary? And we did discuss also how In 2008, she was also heavily favored to gain the Democratic nomination. But that unraveled it in a way. When you have this conception of yourself or your candidacy as the most viable, you only have down really to go mm-hmm. to. And so I still, you know, I'm a researcher. I have no particular stance on who is going to win on. I don't have a stake in who wins. But I think I do have a desire to see women in positions of power, especially visible positions of power like the United States. But I also think that if Hillary Clinton did win, which I think is such a big if, is she departing so much from that prevailing pattern of the spouse of the former president being the first woman to break the executive glass ceiling? And so I just wonder, even if she did become the first woman president of the United States, is that so revolutionary when we look at how that's how women have traditionally been able to do it around the world?
And being the first doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be automatically successful.
And sometimes you're under more scrutiny.
Of course.
And I think that because women are so underrepresented in politics, especially as dominant presidents, that when you make mistakes, sometimes there is this tendency to attribute these mistakes to things like, well, this is why, you know, to, you know, kind of bluntly say, well, that's because she's a woman. We shouldn't have had a woman in this position. If we think... If we thought that George W. Bush's presidency was a failure, and I'm not saying that it was, but if we did say that, if that was the conclusion that historians draw 30 years from now, I don't think that people would raise the possibility of, well, we shouldn't have had a man in the position. Maybe somebody would say, well, we shouldn't have had an heir to the throne in this position. But I think that because women are so underrepresented, that the tendency is still going to be to make these vast conclusions about them, for good or for bad, because they're women.
And I think we can probably look at it the same way with regard to our first African-American president 30 years from
now.
Right. Though people look at it that way.
You're right.
In your view, given the research that you've done and the way you've approached this whole subject, do you think that Hillary Clinton lost in 2008 because she was a woman?
I don't think that she lost in 2008 because she's a woman. I don't think that the data is there to support that. What I do think she was subjected to was gender treatment. I don't think that people would have let journalists get away with some epithets that would have been used, maybe that were racial epithets, similarly that were used against Clinton, especially regarding her appearance, or things that were uttered by a lot of political pundits, you know, who were very ideological. I think she successfully kind of demonstrated that people can get beyond their stereotypes of women and men. And a good example of that is how when people were asked about between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, who was more compassionate, who was more honest, I think, was one of the questions. They thought that Barack Obama had those qualities. When they were asked about who would be a stronger leader, they viewed as, I think, Hillary Clinton as bringing more leadership credentials to the table. And that's usually not what we stereotypically assign to women and men. And so I think that she's a good example of how hypotheticals give way to these blunt stereotypes. But when you insert real people in real campaigns utilizing specific strategies to overcome these kinds of stereotypes, they can sometimes be successful, although to a large extent, she still had to do this balancing act that maybe a man in her position wouldn't have had to.
But
to
I wonder if we can call any of these things baggage that she carried in 2008, if that isn't behind her now. This has been discussed and done, and
right.
it's a different time, and all of this, we know everything there is to know about Hillary Clinton.
So number one, there will always be digging up something else. Number two, she has these foreign policy credentials now, you would think, but Benghazi, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's still not behind her. And so that's just going to be fodder for for the other side. So I think, yes, there's always something new to dig up. Well, and they don't, it doesn't even have to be accurate. It's just, it can be an accusation that can sometimes take a life of its own. She's already being told that she'll be too old. Of course, McCain heard the same thing.
And Joe Biden is hearing it now if he chooses to run.
Yeah. So, but specifically being told by people like Rush Limbaugh that nobody wants to see an aging woman in the White House. So, I mean, I don't know that we've gotten past anything. I don't know. But I would love to be convinced otherwise. That would be, you know.
We have a couple of years to sort it out, unbelievably. I mean, we're talking about the 2016 presidential race. Of course, the election cycle never seems to end in this country. A lot of things that I'd like to talk about, but we have listeners who want to get into the conversation too, Farida. So let's begin with Kristen calling from Imperial, Missouri. Kristen, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
In my opinion, the problem with women getting into politics, the first issue is that the political arena in America, unfortunately, is still filled with many older men who subscribe to the ideology that women are the weaker sex. So that is an issue. The second part of the problem I see is that when a woman does want to run for a position like president, she has to stand for every woman because there's been so few before her, and I don't think that's fair to her, and I don't think that's fair to women in general, because just because, you know, Hillary Clinton is a woman does not mean that I should feel like I have to vote for her or I'm betraying my sex or something like that. So those are my comments.
Mm-hmm. I think Kristen raises a couple of good points. I think that there are still ideologies that are sexist in nature that operate. And sometimes they're, again, overt, sometimes they're more subtle. But think about the subtle connections that one makes socially that situate all, you know, men with power together and not necessarily including women in those dynamics. And then I think she raises also a really important point about how difficult and impossible it would be for one woman to represent all women, because as we know, not all women feel the same way about issues. And that if you even tried to represent women just because you share the same biological characteristics as them, it could, you know, offend some. And I think people were, I think I was offended when people assumed that, oh, as a woman, and if I was a Hillary Clinton supporter, that I would automatically go and vote, you know, for McCain because he was bringing Sarah Palin onto the ticket. I mean, what about ultimately, it's not just about the descriptives. What are they standing for? And how does that align with my views and my desires?
So I'm sure then that you are not happy when you hear the media say that Hillary has already got the women's vote.
I'm not happy because she, if we look at the statistics from the primary, yeah, she did better with women, but there were still a sizable percentage of women that were supporting Barack Obama, maybe younger women in particular. Yeah. But we are not on all on the same sides of the issues. And even if we do have a gender gap, you know, it's fairly modest, and there's a lot more complexity to one's views that go beyond one's gender.
Back to the phones. Jerry in O'Fallon's been waiting. Jerry, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Well, good morning. Yes, I follow with a lot of interest these studies that determine that who we vote for, our political views, are more formed by our psychological beliefs. And unfortunately, I think we still have a substantial percentage of people in the country that look towards, let's face it, kind of a patriarchal figure to as an authority figure, and they really want someone to take care of problems for them. And you know, I guess we're not, you know, we're still in a sexist age, and kind of a parallel to that. I mean, I have trouble fathoming. You know, say if you are a woman and you are deeply involved in the Catholic Church, I mean, you are willingly taking the part of a second class citizen. And I think, unfortunately, I agree with a woman shouldn't vote for just because of the gender of a candidate, I think that that still plays a part in the fact that you're willing to be subjugated is why a lot of women don't look at themselves or other women as being, say, worthy of being the person making the decision.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you.
I mean, to respond, I think, again, Jerry brought up a lot of good points. I think, though, so we have this backdrop of patriarchy that still presents problems. I would definitely agree with that. And I see that existing even in contexts where women have broken the executive glass ceiling. I think the interesting thing is always, though, trying to renegotiate beliefs in a way that ultimately empower women. And when Jerry brought up the Catholic Church, I just thought about, well, look at the strides that women are starting to make absent family ties in Latin American contexts. And what they've been able to do is infuse new meaning into traditional views that would normally suggest that women wouldn't make good leaders. And what I mean specifically is, and this hasn't just happened in Latin America, I think Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in Liberia is a good example. But instead of it seemingly being a woman's place is just in the home and that they should be there because they're the natural nurturers, you could utilize the traditional role of women as nurturers to also say, women who are nurturers can also be strong. And I always use the example in trying to make this point of my mom. My mom was a nurturer. She was my mom. But boy, oh boy, did I know not to mess with my mom. Do you know what I mean? And so you can try to turn things over. You know, you can renegotiate things, turn things on their heads. And when you're facing daunting contexts where some of these beliefs of women's natural role and men's natural role seemingly are so ingrained, women successfully capitalizing on some of these traditional views, but breathing new life into them and utilizing these kinds of old school beliefs in a new way to empower women. So like a Michelle Bachelet is a good example of somebody who knew she had to balance being a woman, being a potential nurturer in a backdrop of corruption, which we also see a lot of women coming in the aftermath of corruption scandals, with also saying, I was Secretary of Defense. I'm tough. I'm strong. I can be a leader. And women are not just one thing. And we can even renegotiate that traditional view of nurturers and motherhood to say we're strong. Like, people don't mess with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. They call her like the tough grandma. You know, you don't mess with her, even though she has these nurturing traits that she used to bring Liberia together after years and years of bloody conflict. And so I think my point is, I think there are these psychological beliefs that kind of make it patriarchal structures and institutions daunting, but there are ways to combat that and reimagine things and renegotiate things. And when women succeed, they usually utilize strategies that take those kinds of traditional barriers into account.
Margaret Thatcher had no problem going to war in the Falklands.
Right.
I mean, nurturer or not, she did what she thought she had to do at that time.
And her popularity increased when that happened.
And she was one and done, as you said a couple of moments ago. That was the one and only female prime minister in the United Kingdom. I have to take another break. Let's do that now. We are talking with Farida Jalazai, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. We're talking about her book, Shattered, Cracked, or Firmly Intact, Women and the Executive Glass Ceiling Worldwide. We have some phone lines open. If you'd like to come in, do so at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk at stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on air. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back to our conversation with Farida Jalazai, Associate Professor of Political Science at UMSL. She's written the book and we're talking about the book, Shattered, cracked, or firmly intact, women in the executive glass ceiling worldwide. Before we continue our conversation, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Missouri State Auditor released a follow-up report on an audit of the Rockwood School District concerning overpayments to a construction company, among other issues. And South Central Missouri continues to suffer from severe flooding after recent heavy rainfall. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Okay, Farida, back to you and the discussion about the glass ceiling for women in politics, not only in this country, as you put it in your book, but also in countries around the world. Speaking of around the world, I have an email here that I want to get to if I can make this thing work. Brian in St. Louis writes, could your guest compare our political culture with that of Australia, where a female prime minister was hounded from office by loutish men? I think this writer has an editorial point of view on this subject, by loutish men who threw sandwiches at her to suggest she belonged in the kitchen. In Canada, where most of the provincial premiers are now female, where do we fit in with other English-speaking countries, and will our first female president be more like Margaret Thatcher than most of our female politicians?
There's a lot there. So I think the caller, the listener, we'll call him or her, brings up overt sexism that Julia Gillard had to experience in particular as she was leaving the prime ministership, that made it very clear that if that wasn't the reason why she was ultimately losing power, we won't even say that she was losing power because she was a woman, but that the reactions that she had to endure in that position and as she was leaving that position, nobody should have to endure. Blatantly sexist remarks from the opposition in particular, and infighting within the party, because you may not remember, but she came in as prime minister as kind of a coup. And then the same person that she displaced, I think his last name was Rudd, I'm not sure, wanted to take power back. And so there's the in-party fighting, and then opposition attacks. And I just think that overt sexist epithets are never tolerable. Where would the United States fit in? I think a woman would potentially have to endure those types of attacks. Are they widespread? Are they mainstream? I think one of the good things about the silver lining about the Julia Gillard case, though, there was a lot of uproar. And she helped, you know, bring momentum to those, you know, she brought a lot of light herself to the media about the experiences that she had to deal with because, in many respects, because she was a woman. Again, I'm not saying she lost her position because she's a woman, but the types of insults she had to endure. Now, the other question, will the first female president of the United States be like Margaret Thatcher or not? I've often thought about who that first woman would be. And I have really thought that the first woman would possibly be somebody who was more conservative and possibly more, in a way, Margaret Thatcher was complicated as far as, you know, she was more masculine in style. But I feel like she was a little bit more complicated because she also knew that she had to be pictured by the press in very feminine roles. I think that in a way that hypothetical of the first female president being maybe on the Republican ticket might be more palatable to some. But I also would have predicted that the first African-American president of the United States would have been a Republican. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? And so they're valuable ways of thinking about, you know, theoretically how this would go. But on the other hand, sometimes reality just takes a very different shape. And I could see in some ways how a female, more conservative Republican woman in the United States could get the position. But I could also see how there's so few really to begin with, right? Women in general and then women in the Republican Party. Is it a realistic scenario?
I was going to ask you, you're a political scientist, and don't answer it if you don't choose to, who you do see out there. I mean, who out there, we've talked about Hillary Clinton, and, you know, she will or won't run, she will or won't win. Who else do you see out there that at the present time that, you know, would have a chance?
I don't think it would happen now, but maybe in Elizabeth Warren. Maybe in Elizabeth Warren, because you know, I think that she would definitely have to be in the Senate longer. But I think she has earned a lot of respect from people, and that she has that sort of expertise in finances. But she also has a lot of opposition from as you can imagine, the other side. So she's somebody that comes to mind as somebody that who's also inspiring, because you want the whole package. You want she's very smart, elite educated, very well versed in matters that people are concerned about when we're thinking about the economy, but also has that charisma that I think is a criterion that you have to bring to the table. People have said things about, well, maybe is it Kathleen Sebelius?
Mm-hmm.
But then automatically kind of discount her because they say, but she's not very charismatic or very exciting as a speaker.
She's also very heavily involved in Obamacare, mm-hmm. which carries some baggage, I think, in a lot of people's minds. Mm-hmm. The Republican side?
I have no idea.
Well, I'll throw out a name.
Okay.
Jan Brewer, governor of Arizona. And there are a lot of female governors,
right. That's true.
Which you know, kind of works against your thesis here, mm-hmm. to one degree, because mm-hmm. there are a lot of them and a lot of very
mm-hmm.
good ones.
Mm-hmm.
But someone like Jan Brewer, who mm-hmm. points her finger at the president of the United States.
Right. I think that she would have some fans, but I think she's very polarizing. Right. I think she's a very polarizing figure.
Well, let's have some fun. What about Sarah Palin?
I think that she was a disaster the first time. I did a lot of defending of Sarah Palin as the vice presidential candidate because I thought that she was really unfairly treated by members of the press and even in members of the Democratic Party. I don't think that she's somebody that is a realistic option. She's way too controversial.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. I wonder, however, if the campaign that she had last time around, if that is a setback for women in general. Do you think so?
It happened at the same time or shortly after we had the Hillary Clinton candidacy. And I think that what I'm hopeful about, we'll see what happens in a few years. I think that we've started to demystify the presidency as, you know, really shedding light on how women could be viable. Hillary Clinton didn't win the nomination. Nobody would have said, though, that she wasn't viable. And I think that what I'm hoping is that instead of there being the one woman on each side that's trying to run, and usually the woman before Hillary Clinton was running would usually be the one who was like, oh, she's just a symbolic candidate. She has no chance.
Elizabeth Dole, Shirley Chisholm, people like that.
People like that, and that there would be one of them usually in a sea of suits. What I'm really hoping for is that in an open election cycle, that there would be next to seven men, you know, three women, and then maybe five women and five men. And so I think that people have been exposed to the possibilities as, you know, more than ever before of women in high profile positions. And that I think I would hope that people would be able to separate the quality of candidate from the gender of the candidate and maybe be able to do that more because we are just starting to see women more routinely in positions of power, even though I will definitely argue that they are still few and far between. But I think that we're going to give way to a place and a time where it's no longer unimaginable, because I think Hillary Clinton did make it imaginable.
I think it's imaginable. Mm-hmm. No, I really do. Let's take a call from Licia, our friend. Go ahead, Licia.
Hey, I wanted to mention the very smart elephant in the room, that it did take a woman to tackle this topic. Good job. Yay, you. and I want to see if I can phrase this correctly. With this country having so many women in upper positions but not having a female president, did you notice that if there were women, if there were a larger proportion of women in the other countries where there are dominant presidents? Does that make sense?
So are you saying, like, women in maybe making more strides in the professions and educational institutions or something of that nature?
Well,
yeah.
Well, in the other countries, for example, Merkel being the president of Germany, is there a larger proportion of women in politics country than there is in the United States?
Okay. So let's put it more generally. So does the proportion of women in other political positions help predict if a country has a female prime minister?
I think that's the
president.
Point. And Merkel, by the way, is prime minister, not president.
Right. What I found statistically is that there is a pipeline effect, that the greater percentage of women in the legislature, the more prone a country was to a woman being president or prime minister. I didn't find the same effect when it came to the cabinets. And what I also wanted to point out was that the way that I viewed the pipeline working was in a way where, realistically, I mean, we wouldn't necessarily look at 2013 and say if there was an election in the United States in 2013, well, let's look at that there's 20%, you know, women senators. So there's maybe going to be a reasonable chance that one of them will become, you know, president now. What I thought was more likely to happen is that, you know, the figures maybe 5 or 6 or 10 years before that period of time that I was looking at would more likely kind of better predict the trajectory of a woman being able to use that lower level office in a way where she could work her way up and become a reasonable recruit for politics. And so, yeah, there is a connection legislatively that countries with higher percentages of women in the legislatures are more likely to have women who ultimately become executives.
I want to take us a little off point now, because I think a lot of people are talking about this and wondering, and maybe you have some insight. Huma Abedin, Anthony Weiner's wife, standing by her man through this scandal that he's been going through. What do you make of that? Here is a woman in and of her own right, extremely accomplished, a great resume, and people are wondering, what the heck is she doing? Farida, what the heck is she doing?
Okay, how am I supposed to figure it out?
Because you're the political scientist in the office.
Likewise, just as a spectator, I have, you know, I continually scratch my head because, like, great credentials, as you say. We'll never know what goes on in that personal dynamic. And I think maybe somebody could have understood after the first time, after the first revelations and after dealing with that, everything that she had to deal with the first time, but then the second round. But we see this routinely, maybe not with people who have the same credentials as Abedin. But doesn't that happen more often than not? I don't know if there's any systematic studies, but I think more often than not, they stand by their mans, men.
But that famous line from Hillary Clinton way back when, not going to be a Tammy Wynette baking cookies and standing by your man. As time gets away from us here, just one point with regard to Huma.
Yeah.
Does this cloud people's minds about women in general? I mean, a lot of people think that it's ridiculous that she's doing this. How does it hurt women, or does it?
Okay.
In a minute.
So this is what I'm going to do to kind of dodge that tricky question. Is I'm going to say, why are we even thinking about her reaction? Why aren't we thinking as much about why Weiner was able to even have the guts to run for the mayorship?
Because
people were supporting him.
People
afterwards.
Respect her and admire her and are wondering what she's doing. It seems counterintuitive.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what to make of it. I think that it's frustrating, but I also don't know that I don't know the inner workings of their marriage, and I don't know the inner workings of I know that they have a child and it makes everything more difficult, but I feel really profoundly sympathetic because I think it would be so difficult to deal with this just invisibly, right, in the comfort of your own home. But you're almost inviting that when the decision is made for him, which I think she was supporting, for him to become, you know, at least a candidate for the
Some people have suggested that she really wanted to be the wife of the mayor.
So
it was as simple as that. But who knows? That's speculation. Yeah. Farida Jalazai, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a fascinating conversation. Good luck with the book.
Thanks.
The book, once again, is Shattered, Cracked, or Firmly Intact, Women and the Executive Class Ceiling Worldwide. A very, very interesting read indeed. Thank you again so much for
being
with us, and good luck. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at downtown living and whether it's living up to our expectations. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.